Focusing meditation, that's what we've been talking about primarily this morning, where you hone the mind and make it one-pointed on a topic, make it very serviceable so that when you apply it to anything else, it's right there on the topic without being distracted whatsoever. And in fact, that what comes with that, when your mind is that focused, you get a certain suppleness of mind and body. He was talking about how you feel like you're flying even. You have a lightness. So that's the first part. But then once you've developed that honed focus, you're not done because you haven't really gotten at the target. So what is the target here? It's inherent. The bad guy in Buddhism is inherent existence. That's the problem, is this false appearance and apprehension of true and inherent existence. And there are a lot of different ways to talk about that. True and inherent existence, things having a self nature, things being arising from their own side, being established from themselves without depending on anything else, independent of anything else. So that's the bad guy, because we have had this bad habit since beginningless time of overlaying on top of what exists this false mode of existing, that they exist in a certain way that they actually don't. Inherent existence doesn't really exist, but it arises with everything that appears to our minds, and we assent to it. And that makes us very selfish, because we feel that we have some kind of aiminess here from my side, that I'm Amy and I've always arisen. Not just in the sense of like you're a teenager and you're, you know, you don't want your anyone to see that your parents dropped you off at the mall, you arose from a lotus, you did not you do not have any, you know what I'm talking about. But even deeper than that you think you have something that establishes you from your own side. That's the big target, because it makes us oriented towards self, doing everything from self, and then all our afflictions are built upon that. All this anger, jealousy, and so forth have at their heart this self-grasping and self-cherishing that stems from these false appearances and and the fact that we assent to them. So you can see that if you want to be a Buddha, who is somebody who switched everything around so that they're not focused at all on themselves, and they're focused on completely other-oriented and sending out all these bodies we talked about spontaneously to help others, that would require not having what kind of congeals, you know, not they're freed up. They don't have this false appearance. And they don't assent to it. They know that it's entirely mistaken. They've cleansed their mind of all of that. So that's the target. So you focused your mind, and then in order to get at this target, you have a meditation that you're still absorbed in that one-pointed focus on the mere clarity and awareness of the mind. And then with a corner of your mind, you analyze the self, the person meditating. And with respect to that, you gain some insight into the selfless nature of your own person. And Geshe-la was talking about that in response to a question. Then, and as he said, after you understand the selflessness with respect to yourself, then, well, it's sort of like once you've seen selflessness of one object, you see it's implied. You can kind of see the selflessness of everything. So you then put your mind on other phenomena other than your own personal self, and you see the selflessness of phenomena. And then there's a final step to the meditation, which is that when you're a yogi one-pointed on emptiness, the lack of inherent existence, inherent existence is a mere absence. You kind of think of it as like a laser, a nullifying laser. Anything that comes in its path is nullified. And because anything that tries to appear to a mind one-pointed on emptiness will not appear, because what emptiness does is it sees its lack of inherent existence. Whatever object would come into its sphere, the mind is one pointed on its absence, its absence of inherent existence. So emptiness, by the way, is the emptiness of individual things. It's not one thing called emptiness. Emptiness is in relation to objects. We'll talk about that in a minute. But nothing can appear to that mind that's one-pointed on emptiness. So when you step up out of your meditation, then things start appearing to you again. And you have to, you're not quite finished. You're not quite omniscient yet. So what you have to work with, what's left over, these sort of subtle obstructions to omniscience that you have to work with, is the fact that things still keep appearing to your mind. And they appear as inherently existent, even though you no longer are sucked in by it. And you have to keep divesting yourself of layers of the stains of having believed in inherent existence for so long, until you come to see appearances and emptiness at the same time. You can see the conventional way things exist and their emptiness at the same time. So that's called subsequent attainment, I think is how he phrases it. So he has a long phrase, but it's basically what you do when you get up from the cushion, and how you work with what appears to your mind is still a meditative thing. So, okay, within all of that really complicated meditation, we have the conventional level of the mind and the deepest nature and the deepest level of the mind. So what are these conventional and deepest, and what are we talking about? These are the two truths, or the two levels of truth. And they aren't actually truths in the sense that we often use the term. In fact, are you there? Okay, it was the sound of somebody else coming in. This is a classification that's found in all forms of Indian Buddhism. And what they are is actually a division of phenomena. You know, all things that can be known are divided either into conventional or deepest truths. So deepest truth, to start there, it refers to emptiness, or as he calls it in this book, voidness. The deepest truth about any object or any phenomena is its emptiness of being truly or inherently existent. Now, a lot of times that's translated as ultimate truth, and Berzin, as a translator, has chosen not to use the word ultimate truth for a purpose, and he says it's because when you say ultimate truth, it sounds like you've come to the ultimate thing that exists. But the danger there is that you'll reify emptiness itself, because even emptiness is said to be empty. Emptiness is empty. It is not the final thing that you come to and you found it. It's the building block of the universe. It's emptiness. It's not. Even emptiness itself is empty. In other words, it's not that emptiness is the only thing that's real and substantial, because how could emptiness be real and substantial when you're negating that things are real and substantial? So emptiness is an absence. It's an absence of a certain way or manner of existing of an object. Phenomena lack inherent existence. So what does this inherent mean? Inherent existence, were it to exist, would be some kind of defining feature inside the object that makes it what it is. Like a table would have tableness, or I would have some kind of aiminess that would exist inside me that makes me Amy without needing anything else. And I was thinking about this with relationship to names, how names seem to really apply to what they are. Like with, I was thinking about the royal baby. Before they named him George, before giving him the name George, he was the royal baby, or the prince, but now he's George. And, you know, I was also thinking about when my kids, before I gave them the name, now when I think of my daughter, Lexi, she appears to have this quality that makes her Lexi. She seems naturally even set up to have the name Lexi. And I even forget that I gave her the name Lexi, that it was agreed upon between me and my husband. was one of the few names that we both liked. But by now, it seems even that her name comes from her own side. She was Alexei right from the beginning, you know? I forget about those moments in the hospital when she was a no-name little form ball. And still, so that's not inherent existence, but the maybe it's the inherent existence of the name, but I'm using that as an illustration of how things really seem to come from their side. So inherent existence would mean something endemic to itself that makes it what it is. It would exist by its own power without needing to rely on anything else because it naturally inheres right there. I never know how to pronounce that. So while I was preparing for this learning intensive, thinking of a really preposterous illustration. I was imagining, what if you had a choice between a dependently existent significant other or an inherently existent significant other? What if it was like, you know, you go to pick your mate and you had a choice? Clearly, you would really have to go for the dependently existent significant other, and I'll tell you why. Because first of all, well, my inherently existent husband might be good-looking, but his looks would be frozen. Because since the body wasn't dependent on any constituents inherited from his parents, or they arose from his own side, so he was just born in his adult form, and he isn't going to age. And so he's really going to make me look bad. So that goes out the window. And what about in terms of relating to him? I mean, he'd be really boring because there would be no way to relate to him. I mean, I don't think we could even hold a conversation because that would imply that he could respond and change in accordance with a changing environment. And so I doubt he could handle my various outbursts of emotion, my mood swings, or even more my more pleasant attitudes. So, you know, who needs him? And furthermore, I wouldn't be able to do anything to improve him. And what else is the point of having a husband? I mean, everybody knows that it's the job of the wife to change your husband and tweak him a little bit. But this is boring dude is just inherently existent, which means that certain of his qualities, like his stubbornness, just inhere right there in him. And they're endemic to him, and he would get away with saying, that's just how I am. And it would be true. I wouldn't even be able to argue with him or debate him on anything. So the mind that arrives at voidness does so by searching for this, searching for some kind of concrete, absolute, findable, inherent self-nature of an object, something that is there from the side of the object, making it what it is. And then the mind that searches for that comes up with a lack. It's not there, I can't find it. And that is a realization of something, that the independent self-nature does not exist. And so voidness is called, in Berzin's language, a non-affirming nullification. A non-affirming nullification. The nullification part means that it comes up with an absence. It's the lack of inherent existence. It directly perceives an object's lack of existing intrinsically, truly, or inherently, as if it had its own self-nature without needing to rely on anything else. So the non-affirming part means that in negating this self-nature, it doesn't come up with a substitute or leave any residue. There's no, oh, this is emptiness. It's just a lack. And Berzin gives two good examples that help us understand the difference between an affirming nullification and a non-affirming nullification. And these are very simple examples, but I think they help a lot. An example of an affirming nullification is a table without a tablecloth. So you nullify that there's no tablecloth on this table, but you're left with a table. So you have an affirmation of something in the wake of having nullified that it has this tablecloth on it. However, if you talk about the absence of a tablecloth, there's nothing left in its wake. It's just a lack of something, no tablecloth. So that's a non-affirming nullification, a mere absence. It negates, similarly, emptiness negates inherent existence and doesn't leave anything as some kind of remainder of how things exist. And Geshe-la was referring to this in answering somebody's question about Dzogchen, that, and His Holiness goes into this in this book, that when the Dzogchenpas, when they do their meditations, they end up with an affirming negative. And when we do this Mahamudra practice, we end up with void, come at voidness and come up with an absence. And then His Holiness goes on to say that yet, but they're coming from it at this angle, and it implies a non-affirming nullification. So they do, in fact, come to the same point. So he used that terminology in trying to show, in response to the Panchen Lama's very potent argument that, wow, all these things come to the same point, he used this language to show how they actually do come to the same point. But for our purposes, let's just say, okay, we're trying to get familiar with, you know, what is the deepest nature of things? They're empty of inherent existence, and that that's a mere absence, a lack of something. So conventional truths. Conventional truths are the bases for emptiness. That is, those phenomena that have the quality of being devoid of inherent existence. Such phenomena appear to the mind, and it is in relation to these phenomena that one sees their deepest nature. So this means that when emptiness negates that things are inherently existent, it doesn't negate that things exist at all. It doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. There are still trees and chairs and people and gorillas and bananas and so forth. It just, emptiness refutes their mode of existence. For instance, the false nature that baby George seems to have without refuting that Prince George exists. It's a prince, right? Let me put that there.
The phrase you said, conventional truths are the bases of, what's the word?
Bases for emptiness. Emptiness is the emptiness of an object.
Right.
So there are things, phenomena, that appear to the mind. This is a tricky topic, but I'm coming at it with that description, with a purpose in mind. Often it's said that conventional phenomena are like illusions, and they are like illusions in that they appear one way, but their mode of existing is otherwise. And as His Holiness points out, it's on page 161, conventionally existent food can produce an effect. It can fill our stomach. An illusion of food cannot. So things are, on one level, valid, okay? But they are like illusions in that they do not exist the way they appear to. They do not exist in the way they appear to have this inherent existence, able to, their own self-nature, able to set themselves up on their own side, but that does not exist. So it is valid on some level to say that food exists, or to say I'm thinking, I am deciding. And as Berzin puts it, it's what is absent is an actual findable me sitting in our head doing all of this. So for example, with regard to the self, we feel as though there's some kind of self that's the controller of the mind and the body and so forth, and that's the part that doesn't exist. So what kind of existence, then, do conventional objects have? It's refuted that they have some kind of independent, inherent existence. They aren't able to set themselves up on their own. Then what type of existence do they have? If they lack independent existence, that means they have dependent existence. They are dependently arisen. And this is where we get into talking about dependent arising. And there are many levels of talking about dependent arising. And in fact, if you ever want to go back to this, on page 150, His Holiness talks about four levels of dependent arising. The first one of which has to do with how we get trapped in cyclic existence. It's the topic of the 12 links of dependent arising, and it's a study of ignorance and how it works together with these other factors, and we get embroiled in lifetime after lifetime. And so it shows from that angle of the story of how we get involved in samsara continually and build up lifetimes and lifetimes, how we are dependently arisen in that sense. Another level of dependent arising is this, that all functional and permanent phenomena arise in dependence upon causes and conditions. And this is, can be very easily illustrated by, if you just take the example of a flower, that a flower, you can't have a flower without having a soil and seed and moisture and sunshine and so forth. So the flower doesn't, you know, pop out on its own. It's based on causes and conditions. A third level is dependent arising in terms of parts and wholes, that you have a table, not as just it arose in its tableness, it's dependent on parts. It's got, well, I don't know, I shouldn't use this table as an example. It just be a little bit more simple. You know, four legs and a top, you know, for some tables.
The lower table.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Oh, does it have four? Yeah. This table has four legs and a top. And so it's established based on these parts coming together. It's dependently arisen. There's nothing. And that's a really kind of, it seems so simple. And yet you ever kind of catch yourself if you're walking around, you know, you can just think about parts and wholes as a way of training yourself in this idea of dependent arising, where you just like one time I looked at a stop sign and I went, oh, wait a minute, you know, a stop sign is, you know, the metal part that goes up and some bolts and a this and a that, and I just go stop sign and glom, it's a whole, it's a thing. But it's based on all these things coming together. But the fourth one is the one that's really the most important in this context of Mahamudra, and it's also the hardest to understand, and that's that the existence of all of phenomena of samsara and nirvana arises or is established dependently by virtue of mental labeling. Things exist and function inasmuch as they can simply be mentally labeled or imputed. Okay? Some of you who are more familiar with the Hopkins type language, that they're imputed upon their bases of designation.
Oops.
Oh, oops, because there's too much verbiage. Sorry. I'll repeat the Burzin one and then we'll pick it apart. Things exist and function inasmuch as they can simply be mentally labeled or imputed. The level of existence that they have is that they are mentally labeled or imputed. So what is this mental labeling thing? Mental labeling is when a mind applies a word or a concept to signify the extent of what something is. Two other words for it are imputation or designation, and that occurs upon what is called a basis for imputation. So you have a collection of parts, and upon that, your mind, that it is the referent of a mind that conceptualizes them or gives them a term. And that's it. That is this simply exists simply by being mentally labeled or imputed to exist. So the basis of imputation of the table is the four legs in the top, and then we give it the imputation table, and that's enough for it to exist and function. Mental labeling does not go beyond that, beyond what is conventionally the case. Burzin puts it this way in an article. It's a mouthful, but I think it says it very clearly. Existence in terms of mental labeling means existing conventionally as this or and not that, dependently on being the referent object of the mental labels this and not that, when those mental labels are validly imputed on a basis for labeling. Okay, I'll say that again. You have a basis for labeling. You have an object. That's all that means. The basis for labeling of the table are these parts. This, you know, four legs and a top. So that's the basis. Your mind has to be valid in imputing table. You can't, in other words, if you're having an eye consciousness of the appearance of what the table looks like, its form and its shape, then if you have some kind of something wrong with your eyes and so forth, you aren't necessarily going to have a valid consciousness of the table, right? So you've got a basis for labeling, and then we're talking about valid cognition. The kind of existence that the table has is that it's being mentally labeled as this and not that, table, not chair, not this, not that, dependently on being the referent object of our calling it table. It's the referent object of our term, table, or our thought about the table. All phenomena are merely imputed by terms and conceptuality, independence upon their bases of imputation, of their bases, their various parts through which we say on them, that is a chair, that is a book, okay? So what this is saying is that phenomena exist because the mind can give rise to an appearance of them as objects of cognition. Phenomena exist as what they are because of the meaning of words and conceptual formulations on them. Okay, and this is tricky, and maybe Geshe-la will talk about dependent arising some, and maybe he'll help us with it.
Should I hold off on the question?
Yes, because I'm hoping to get through a little bit more. I would like to go through the definitions, mere clarity and awareness, because I think that's kind of right on target with where Geshe-la is, and then if we have time for questions, I can punt the rest. The last thing I wanted to say about these two truths, and I know this is a tricky topic, but basically we're talking about phenomena and their emptinesses, things that appear to the mind and their emptinesses, conventional objects and their lack of existing as inherently existent. So what's so great about a Buddha is that they're able to see these two levels of truth at the same time. And so you can, you know, what we're talking about in that last stage of the meditation, you know, you're chipping away at any vestige of, well, basically you have an omniscient Buddha is able to see how things exist at the conventional level and also their emptiness at the same time. So naturally, that's why the practices are geared towards helping the person realize emptiness and then also understand appearances and be able to see conventional appearances and their emptinesses. Eventually, those two things come together and they're able to see them at the same time. So we begin with the conventional level, so-called conventional level, of the nature of the mind as mere clarity and awareness. So when you do this focusing meditation where you're stabilizing your mind and focusing, your object is the mind, and the definition of mind is that it is mere clarity and awareness. So when we talk about what a mind is, the mind isn't really an organ, like kind of like we normally think of it as like your brain or something, or, you know, blood, heart pumps blood, you know, your mind gives you thoughts and experiences and stuff. It seems like it's a thing that does something, but it's not. It's not object. We're talking about something. We're talking about mental activity. So again, with that flashlight example, it's not that there's a person holding the flashlight and controlling the flashlight to shine it on objects. It's just the flashlight. So all there is mental activity and appearances. There's no third thing controlling it all. The mind doesn't have a form, it's formless. The mind is individual. There's not one collective mind. So mind is experience. It's cognizing things. It's what's happening from moment to moment for each of us. Now, mind always has an object. As part of this activity, your mind has content. As Berzin explains, the Buddha taught the non-duality of subject and object. And what this doesn't mean that the mind is the shape of the table that it's seeing, but that at the moment that you have the sight of the table, the appearance of the table's form comes together in the same package as the mind having that moment of sight of the table's form. You can't have a moment of mind when it's not experiencing something. So I like that phrasing that he says, that it's come together in the same package. Reminds me of the Reese's peanut butter cup. You have the mind experiencing something and the what it is experiencing always together. So the mind is mere clarity and awareness. So what is this word clarity? This clarity aspect sounds as though it involves kind of focusing in, but that's not what it's about. That's why some people call it luminosity. It's about the giving rise to something, the activity of giving rise to cognitive appearances. And this isn't necessarily visual. So we have a moment of hearing a bird chirp, just a single moment. So what appears to our mind is the sound of the bird chirping. That's an appearance, a cognitive appearance. It's just that we have a hard time getting away from visual language when we talk about this topic. In this sense, even confusion involves this aspect of clarity and that something is appearing to the mind, however confused it is. Okay? So clarity refers to giving rise to a cognitive appearance of something, whether that's appearance is focused or blurred. It's just this, we're going around mentally giving rise to appearances of all sorts of different things. Awareness, the other part to the definition, it also has some problems with it, the English, because it sounds as though we're conscious of something, but this isn't necessarily the case. Awareness is the mental activity of making something into a cognitive object that we are aware of. And the Tibetan word is translated as awareness is, Berzin points out, is engagement or relation. And it literally means an entering into something. So it connotes that we're doing something cognitive with the object. So this can be seeing, hearing, thinking about it, feeling it. For instance, there's a rising of the sight and the seeing of it. Okay? That's the arising of the sight is the clarity, and the seeing of it is the cognitive engagement, the awareness. And it sounds as though these are it's a two-step process, like something arises and then we grab hold of it or something like that, but it's not. They happen at the same time, that the mind is having something appear to it and then is also experiencing it. Those two things are together. Now, what does the mirror do? Mirror indicates that this happens without the person holding the flashlight, that there is no person, there's no content that's actually really real. you can say, I saw the cat, but there is no solid concrete me who controls it and makes me see the cat. There's no cat that exists out there separately from my mind perceiving it. And no solid concrete experience occurring, because all of these things are lack inherent existence. Okay? But in particular, mirror means that this is just what's happening moment to moment without some kind of person controlling it all. So I thought I'd read to you this definition from His Holiness. Mere clarity and awareness refers to the fact that mind is something that, when it meets with the proper circumstances, can, without obstruction, give rise to an appearance of anything as something that is known. In this respect, mind is somewhat similar to a mirror that on an external, non-cognitive level, unobstructively also gives rise to appearances of objects. So we've got this mirror that reflects physical objects, and our mind is kind of similar. It gives rise to these appearances. No matter what aspect of what external object we encounter, its sight, sound, smell, taste, or tactile or physical sensation, clarity is that which allows for a corresponding aspect to arise or appear unobstructedly. Awareness is an engaging with or pervading of an object in such a way as to render it something that is known, unobstructedly in one way or another. Thus, from another point of view, clarity and awareness are absences of obstruction that would prevent anything from arising as something that is known. This is the mind's nature of being mere clarity and awareness. So this is the very thing that Geshe-la was talking about this unobstructive quality to the mere clarity and awareness of the mind. That they are absences of obstruction. Things come to the mind because nothing gets in the way. Okay? They're sort of a space in which that can happen.
Even in samsara.
Yeah, even in samsara. And in nirvana. And that's what's going on continually. In fact, primally, primordially, that you have the mind giving rise to objects and cognizing them, and that continues forever. So we have 15 minutes, and my topics were to talk about the mind as an appearance maker and the problem. What is the problem with our level of cognition? Not necessarily in that order, but you had a question first. So I'm going to take a break from this and answer a few questions. Is that better?
My question is sometimes just becomes a rabbit hole, and I just don't want to.
No. Go for it.
Well, okay, now I have to sort of pull it back. But you were referring to valid cognition with regard to conventional reality. And I mean, sometimes conventional reality is viewed as, you know, an obscured reality, a diluted, you know, perception of reality. But you're saying that the definition of conventional reality is that reality that it stands scrutiny and can be sort of designated.
I actually have a question about this, and I wish I could ask Geshe-la, like, right this second. A lot of times when the two truths are talked about, sometimes conventional reality is referred to as sort of like truth for jerks, truth for, there are actually falsities, because conventional phenomena are that which appear to the mind, of beings within cyclic existence, and they don't exist the way they appear, and so in that sense they're falsities. And so sometimes when you talk about the two truths, they do it in that manner, where they say conventional truths are that which arise, are phenomena, and they appear to sentient beings, because if sentient beings are infected with this false perception of everything is inherently existent. However, we're talking about in this book, it also goes on to say that a Buddha can simultaneously realize the two truths. And the way it talks about that, it's talking about what you're left with when you're a Buddha who doesn't do that anymore. That phenomena still exist. They still have a conventional reality. And so I think this last part of my talk, I was going to talk, I think might help, which is that when phenomena appear to the mind, there are pure appearances and impure appearances. The problem with sentient beings is that we don't just mentally label what exists. We go beyond that and we mentally fabricate, it's called, which means that we overlay onto what exists this false mode of existing, this impossible manner of existing that things inherently exist. So for us, even as things just appear, You know, they, and just at this very initial stage of things appearing to the mind, they come at us when as inherently existence in the very low. So, okay, I'm trying to say too many things at once, but there's appearance and then there's the apprehension of the appearance.
Yeah.
So for sentient beings who are ordinary, things appear as inherently existent, and then they're also apprehended as inherently existent. For somebody who's meditated on emptiness and they've had a direct experience of emptiness, when they come out of that meditation, things still appear as inherently existent, but they no longer apprehend them as inherently existent. Then, for a Buddha, eventually, things no longer appear as inherently existent, but they do still appear to the mind. And so in this book, they're talking about conventional existence is that mere appearance that a Buddha can realize. Even a Buddha can realize these two truths simultaneously. Things will still be appearing to your mind because you can't have a mind without an object. So even for Buddha, they have appearances. So for sentient beings, we have what's called impure appearances. And for Buddhas, they have pure appearances. And actually, for ordinary sentient beings, the two are together like milk and water. That when things come to our mind, when our mind gives rise to appearances, we have the pure level, but right there with it is this impure level of seeing them as inherently existent. So what we're trying to do is get rid of that impure part and be left with the pure.
With regard to the pure part, and this idea that things don't exist from their own side, is there not, say, in the perceptual world, is there not something going on the objective side, some kind of organization of the field, like figure ground relations, if you're thinking about, like, say, visual perception,
I see what you mean.
That we are not responsible. I mean, we can't, I mean, we can project onto something, but the projective mechanism can't create totally the object upon which
in the projected. In the Prasangika Madhyamaka, from their point of view, there are external objects.
Yeah.
Not in Chittamatra, but in Prasangika Madhyamaka, there is an external world. It's but, and this is a big but, and it starts to look very similar to Chittamatra. There is no external world separate from mental labeling, separate from the mind.
So if there weren't sentient beings, there wouldn't...
There would be no external universe. Mm-mm. In fact, it's said that this whole environment is karmically created. It's created from mind. Mm-mm. It's not. Even the Prasangika Madhyamaka says that the external world is created based on karma because... we have certain things that we've done together in the past such that we'd be together in this kind of room with these kinds of conditions and these books available to us, and Geshe-la is here and we've got it good right now. We're experiencing the results of some kind of virtue we did in some life some
so
kind of eons ago.
The planets
are still there's a little section on this karma and the environment. It's really interesting.
Well, remember,
I suggest you go back to that.
Doesn't mean humans.
Oh no, but still, I can't see. I mean, they wouldn't have names. They wouldn't have I mean, there wouldn't be anybody to perceive them. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. There's things that exist that can't be perceived. I mean, the whole definition. Of
I know. Like, if there's no one to perceive it, then does it exist? You know, it's the bear in the woods.
Yeah. And there's vibration.
I know. There's all sorts of questions like that. I've had some interesting talks with Josh about that. I wish I could find this now. And I mean. There are two levels at which this book talks about that. You know, there's the level of talking about mere clarity and awareness, and then there's a talk about the clear light mind and how it gives rise to all. All phenomena are the play of the clear light mind, and that includes the environment.
I think I need to read the article you referred me to earlier.
Can you guys find it?
Well, there's something in Burzum I want to.
It says the word karma.
Reference to this because it says, but that does not mean that everything exists only in the mind and that the earth did not exist before there was life on it.
It's not that everything is only in the mind, but it doesn't exist apart from the mind.
It says an object need not be experienced by a specific mind at this moment in order to exist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It seemed to have something to do with what you said.
Yeah, well, I can sort of relate to that.
This isn't on page 20, but I don't know where that comes from. He just write that. I don't know where he got that from. I have no idea.
Yeah. I thought this was going to be a rabbit hole, by the way. We can move on.
No, I did the last section based on that. I think that I'm content. I just don't know why I can't find this thing. There's a little section and it says karma. Oh, here, the relationship between mind, karma, and the environment. You're right. Somebody said 200. You found it. All three realms of existence are the creations of karmic impulses. The instincts, habits, or propensities built up from our previous actions ripen not only into our experiences of happiness and suffering, but also into the external conditions that provide the circumstances for those experiences. So there's two types of karma. There's throwing karma and completing karma. So your throwing karma is what throws you into the next lifetime, and the completing karma is what completes the picture, gives you the conditions. So you can be born as a dog. You can be born as Peldon, be totally spoiled and padded and live here at the retreat house, or you could be a dog in a back alley someplace. Both those things are related to karma. So in that sense, that shows you a little bit about how karma, which is based on the intentions in the mind, gives rise to the environment. You have a question? Very good question, and I know that comes up on a Burzum website. Where does intention come from? And I wish I'd studied that more, but he basically says it's intention is karma,
yeah.
And that there's no person doing the intending, and intention arises based on causes and conditions. Isn't that hard?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it feels like there's somebody doing it, but it's a mental factor. It is a part of the mind. Mm-hmm.
But the goal is to be good and not to do harm and, you know, to do all those ethical.
It's not saying there isn't any intention. It's saying that the intention is part of this mind that has mere clarity and awareness. It's not that there's a person directing it.
Well, how do those good impulses,
mind can be shifted through this quality of intention.
Well, some of the causes and conditions.
Through will or not.
Will and intention are aspects of the mind, of mental activity. So what's being asserted is that these things exist and we depend upon them to help reach enlightenment, to be better people in this conventional world. But there is no person doing it.
But mm-hmm. Some of the causes and conditions for compassion can be sort of like an act, like pure appearances, like an understanding of the situation with care thrown in, such that this is what you're going to do in this situation, right? I mean, so the causes and conditions can represent a perception that's validly cognized, at least to some degree.
I'm not sure I understand completely. But I'd have to listen again so that I could answer.
I was just thinking about His Holiness that you spoke of, speaking about the mirror. And I had a picture of the mirror and dependent, how things are not as they appear.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have a clear picture. And I use the mirror idea in my mind to see in a mirror, literally, and what appears to be who we are and what we are is totally washed out. If you reach your right hand out
right.
to the mirror and look at the picture in the mirror,
it's
the
reversed.
The mirror is giving you a left
yeah.
hand. So there you have it. You
right.
know, that's clear, what appears to be
yeah.
so.
Have you ever caught yourself looking at the mirror and thinking, that's me?
Yeah.
That's
yes.
me right there. And you don't, you're totally so absorbed that you don't realize it's a reflection and it's just shape and color. Or if you're in a movie, we all have these experiences.
Actually, I've had the other experience. Of just looking in the mirror
and, saying, who's that?
And just trying to find somebody
huh.
all
yeah.
my
life.
That's me.
Well,
who is that old woman?
I think it would be a good question for Geshe-la to ask about intention. Maybe he could shed some light on that. That would be a good question. If there's no person, where does intention come from, I guess? Let's, you know, we can put that down on a piece of paper. Somebody would like to do that.
Say it again?
I'll put that down.
The question of where does will and intention
yeah.
come from? If there's no one directing the mind, then how does that arise within the mind?
Isn't that deeper?
Hmm?
Isn't that deeper? I can't get the words out. Right. You have the mind and what's behind the mind.
In this, there is nothing behind the mind. There's just mind is giving rise to experience, and there's the experience of it, and that's what exists.
The mind has to know what exists. That's it.
Yeah,
mind,
and the mind is doing that. There's a phrase in Walpola Rahula, this book that a lot of beginning Buddhism classes use. There is no thought behind the thinker. Thought itself is the thinker.
Mm-hmm.
I always like that one.
Contains a good
book. Yeah, you were referring to it just the other day. So, but it's exactly 3:00, and I promised that I would end right on time so everybody could get caffeine and get ready for Geshe-la and stretch. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being so good.
No,
students.
You're good.
And,